and a very big welcome to a very large audience for the final lecture in this year's series of Lineker lectures. We've been looking at environmental governance and resilience, and I can think of no better speaker to round off this series than Professor Carl Folk. Carl researches the role that living ecosystems at different scales play in social and economic development, and how to govern and manage for resilience in integrated social and ecological systems. He's science director of the Stockholm Resilience Centre, an increasingly well-known and extremely well-funded research group of approximately 100 or so researchers at the University of Stockholm, an international centre that advances transdisciplinary research for governance of social and ecological systems. And simultaneously, though I don't know how you manage to do two such full-time jobs simultaneously, he's also director of the Bayer Institute for Ecological Economics at the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Currently, he's also chair of the Resilience Alliance, which will be a very familiar grouping to many of you, comprising scientists and organisations across the globe who collaborate to explore the dynamics of socio-ecological systems. And for those of us who try to publish in this very competitive area, he'll perhaps be best known as Editor-in-Chief of Ecology and Society, an innovative online journal. His lecture this evening is entitled Resilience and Socio-Ecological Systems. Professor Folk.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here. I have the opportunity to talk a little bit about some work we try to do on some of the challenges humanity is facing on the planet. I thought I'd start up with this picture because Lauren and I had a discussion over lunch a little bit about interdisciplinarity and what it means. And you can look at this picture as a lot of specialized areas who knows a lot of stuff about particular things, but there are gaps in between. So it's sort of a systems view. And when you try to bridge those gaps, it becomes really blurry. And I guess that's where we are basically today in interdisciplinary work. We're trying to see new patterns and see new ways of doing things, but it still is fairly blurry, and a lot of new hypotheses emerging and new perspectives. But hopefully something surprising may come out of that. And this is a painting by Salvador Dalí, as you may recognize. And it's a surprising life. And the argument we have is that this type of systems understanding is very hard to get when you work from within one discipline, especially given the way the world works today with quite many people on the planet, seven million people. So the question is, can we have any help from the resilience lens on those issues? So what I try to do today is to take you on a little journey of some of those topics, and some things may be totally trivial, but hopefully also you will find one or two surprises in it. So there are three parts of this talk. One is about global change, new forms of interactions on Earth with people and nature as a unified system. The second one is really getting into some of those concepts of resilience thinking, which is basically, we call it persistence, adaptability, and transformability in Stockholm Group. There are different groups who use different terminology. In Stockholm, we use these three. And then give you some examples of transformations in the context of becoming stewards of ecosystems. I know Terry Chapin was here, and he talked about ecosystem stewardship, or stewardship, I think. It relates a bit to that. The Anthropocene is most likely a new geological era. And I know there are discussions of changing the concept from the Holocene to the Anthropocene, basically a planet shaped by humans. It's a new situation for us and also for the Earth to have species that impacts on the whole global system in the way that we are now able to do. And it has to do with the tremendous expansion of our activities. Of course, if you just go back a couple of hundred years, we were 1 or 2 billions, and now we're expanding rapidly. We have an enormous, fantastic interacting global society. It's amazing how we can be 7 billion people in relative peace, and we have an information technology system that connects us, trade, all these issues. We have a truly globalized society today. And it's like an explosion, basically, of our activities, largely triggered by fossil fuels, of course. This is a picture from the cover of The Economist in 28th of May last year, coming out of a meeting that few groups have had on this concept of the Anthropocene. And the point that they make here is that it's not just that we are shaping the planet, but our imprint on the planet would still remain over geological time, even if we would, say, disappear from Earth because of some disease or something like that. So actually we have achieved an enormous influence on the way the whole planet as it operates and functions. An enormous achievement. But there is also a tendency that we have forgotten that we are part of the planet. So that's why my talk is going to concentrate a lot about today is what we call reconnecting to the biosphere. How can we reconnect our own actions and activities to start collaborating with the planet to enhance the likelihood of a good life for people on Earth? Here's an example of a really messy picture from a couple of publications, basically illustrating that issues of climate change, ecosystems, human health, and economic issues are intertwined, also globally. We have some drivers here like the greenhouse gases, antibiotic resistance, increased connectivity, our own consumption and numbers, so on and so forth. That creates a lot of interactions between economic issues, health issues, climate change issues, and ecosystems. That some of those are playing out as shots. For example, there are those who argue that the fires, likely climate-driven fires in Russia, created an export ban of wheat and triggered was one of the triggers for the Arab Spring that we are in right now. And these type of new types of interactions where shocks in the financial markets interact with ecological dynamics and other flows is a new thing for humanity. It has happened locally and regionally, but not at the global scale. So it's another type of phase we are in right now. Some work we've done with lots of groups looking at those issues worldwide also take these steps forward and look into three other aspects that are happening right now. The first is that we're dealing with a new type of great acceleration happening in many countries where people have been really poor and moving into more of a middle class situation. That's a new type of acceleration we're seeing right now, especially in Asia and in India. The new type of global dynamics has surprising elements of it, and I mentioned the one with the Arab Spring. There are most likely that we will have seen new types of these type of turbulent shocks to different parts of the system. And the last one is the amazing new revolution we're going into, deeper and deeper into understanding the microbiology and how the genes function and even start to reshape those and perhaps create new life forms and things like that. That's an enormous new phase that humanity is in right now, also just starting to take off. So if you just think a little bit about these three things in combination of what I showed before, it's quite obvious that we are in a situation of quite turbulent times on the planet right now. And not necessarily for the bad, it could be also for the good. But the point is, how is our knowledge system capable of understanding these turbulent times? Are we prepared? Are we capable of doing that? Today we are more than 50 people in urban areas. Often people in urban areas don't see that they are linked to the planet. We even create mental models in that we don't need it actually. If you look at it, 2.5 generations basically have created a mental model that The environment is a sector out there. It's something we can bring into the economy with a few price tags on, and then things are solved. The point here is that without a functioning biosphere, we won't be able to have a good economy or a social system at all. Just to illustrate that for urban areas, here is that we also globalized ecologically. Here is such a simple thing as a shrimp produced in a pond in Thailand. To produce that pond in Thailand, there are fish meals coming from different parts of the world. Basically, all big oceans worldwide are supporting the production of that shrimp that later is traded to European, Asian, and other markets. And if you go into a sushi bar here in Oxford, perhaps later tonight, and eat the shrimp, it may have been using all marine waters worldwide for the production of that shrimp. So basically, it also illustrates that we are globally dependent on different marine systems, even for production of such a small little thing like a shrimp. So if you add up everything we eat and consume in that context, you realize that we're truly intertwined also in the ecological dimension, not only through technology and through trade and through travel and things like that, but also in the ecological dimension. A way to illustrate that is we looked at the cities in the Baltic Sea region from where I am. And there were about 30 cities with more than 250,000 inhabitants. We just wanted to look how huge areas of ecosystems that are needed to provide the food we eat and some of the timber we use and capturing some of the emissions, sometimes referred to as ecosystem services. In those estimates, we calculated that roughly that every square kilometer of a city requires about 1,000 times bigger area of working ecosystems. So even if you don't like nature, if you don't like the environment, and even if you think it's just a sector that you can use occasionally, the point here is to illustrate that we're still dependent on the work of the biosphere for our daily lives, whether we like it or not, actually. And in this case, it's about 1,000 times bigger area than the area where we are ourselves. This is nowadays referred to as the ecological footprints and these type of concepts, but these were estimated in a different way. And we did this report for a UN conference called Habitat 2, where people looked at sustainable cities, but forgot about the support areas around the cities. So everything was about sustainability in the cities. So here is my worldview, and the way we work from very much in Stockholm is that the economies and our societies are part of the planet. And it's not that the environment is something, the sector or resources we bring into the economy and society, but we are actually part of it and fundamentally dependent on that it works. Otherwise, it will be difficult to have a good, prosperous societal and economic development. That's the mindset. And I guess for you who listen to Bob Costanza, he probably presented something similar on natural capital, the role of natural capital and things like that. So a big challenge then is to become stewards of that life support system, since we're depending on it. It's not about saving the environment for the environment's sake. It's about enhancing the likelihood for a good life for us. So if we forget about that, we will not very likely have a good life, actually, on Earth. So it's a very normative thing I'm saying right now, of course. But really, to be stewards of that life support is precondition in the way we look at it. To give you one example from Maine, and also the role of interdisciplinary work in that context. Here is a case that has been described as one of the very good success stories of collective action, how people come together from local fishermen all the way up to the state of Maine and are connected to global markets and have a very valuable resource, the lobster. Sometimes you may be buying lobster here in Oxford also from Maine. This has been used by people like Eleanor Ostrom and many other people in the Common Pool resource management groups as one of the classical cases of success. And the success has also been measured in terms of not overexploiting the resource. The lobster has not been overexploited. Previously, all other fish species were overexploited. So they have been lost from the Gulf of Maine, but the lobster has not.
So in that context, everything looks good. But if you expand the analysis to the whole ecosystem of Maine, not just the single population of lobsters, you discover that all the species that were preying on lobsters, all its enemies, have been taken away from the system. So the lobster has exploded like an insect population, basically, in the coastal waters, largely because of overexploitation, and has become a huge monoculture. And as you know, monocultures that have no backups in the system are often vulnerable to diseases. A little bit further south, on Rhode Island, 72% of the lobster population have been wiped out by a shell disease, actually. So in this case, if you lose too much of diversity in the system and simplify too much, the system becomes vulnerable. And this is a case of loss of resilience, of course, where the story is that you have built social and economic resilience. I think that that's sufficient. But forgotten about the biosphere and the ecosystem around it, and created vulnerability for the intertwined social ecological system. So this is an example of where if you only do the social sciences, or the only the ecosystem work by itself, you don't see those interactions. Getting back to the first picture I showed with interactions between disciplines. But now they're waking up and try to make a lot of measures to avoid these type of situations, which can be fairly vulnerable, especially to those who have their income from these type of activities. And that gets us into the good idea of thresholds and tipping points. So if the main lobster fishery actually would collapse, it maybe like this. And this is fine for the donkey if it sits for a little while, but it's not fine if it sits there for a long while. And that means that some of those shifts may be largely irreversible, actually. And that gets us to this picture here, which is a metaphor often used for resilience. It's how you shift from one stability basin to another up here. And that's why in resilience thinking, you often have several equilibrium or stability basins of attraction or pathways of development. The point here is that if you look at this curve and you think that this is a lake, for example, and you pour in nutrients into it, nothing happens here at all. You put in one extra kilo and one extra kilo, and everything is the same until you get to that point, and then, poof, it jumps over to another point. So it's not a linear relation here. It's a tipping point, a threshold, non-linear dynamics happening in the system. And that's been described now for many ecological systems. And there's a big debate in ecology to what extent this is actually a general phenomenon or exceptions. But many people have actually shown this, especially a guy called Martin Scheffer in the Netherlands. He's a specialist on this type of, he called it critical transition. This is an excellent book from Princeton University Press, and he describes those phenomena. But this little ball in the cup then would be, say that the lobster fisheries having a lot of diversity in the marine system would not be affected by a disease. But if they are over here and have no other things except for the lobster, they will be very vulnerable, and disease may push them over into a new situation that may be reversible. And that could be a situation for the planet as a whole also, if you think about it in that case. I'll give you another similar example from Borneo rainforests. So this is to show how we are connected across scales, from global markets in one region to landscapes in another place. And it connects basically markets, land use, disturbances like fire or rainfall with regional tipping point and climate. And in these type of forests, when the weather event, El Niño, comes, it sort of heats up the environment a bit and triggers a lot of reproduction of the seeds. So you get a lot of new seeds being thrown out, and the rainforest revives itself out of that. What has happened in Borneo is that huge monocultures have replaced a lot of the rainforest, especially for palm oil production. And oil palm is a substance. Palm oil is a substance we use in a lot of different things, especially in the Western world, to conserve foods and things like that. And also for timber production. And now when the El Niño come, you also get fires there now to a much larger extent.
So before, when the Niño came, it triggered a regeneration of the forest. Now when it comes, it can trigger fires, especially when there are a lot of humans also contributing to that. And if you look down in the right corner here, in 1997 it was burning very much on Borneo. You may remember that, and all the way down to the deep soil levels. And at that year, the fire corresponded to between 30 to 40% of the mean annual global carbon emissions from fossil fuels.
So it's an interesting way of how a global market for a new product may shift the whole region from being a source that regenerates itself to become a sink for carbon to having an effect on the climate system.
Tim Lanton here in the UK, together with Schellenhuber and others in the Potsdam Institute, have identified several of what they call Achilles heels or tipping points or break points regionally on Earth. That if these type of events would happen, will generate new type of interactions that would be hard to predict.
I guess that Terry Chapin had a similar picture up in the earlier of his talk. I listened to his presentation. I didn't see any graphs, but I listened to his presentation. And this is the last 100,000 years on Earth. You could see that this is the Greenland ice core. You could see that the climate temperature variated quite a lot. And here at the last 10,000 years, we have had this, for us, very favorable stable climate here called the Holocene. And that's where it took about 2,000 years after that stable period. Then we started with agriculture. And after that, all the civilizations that we have had have appeared, actually.
So the challenge for us, of course, is to try to remain in that stable basin, because that's where we can thrive. It will be very difficult for us to have to move around quite a lot when the climate goes up and down like this. So how can we try to do that? And that's why we did it these couple of years back now, called the planetary boundaries, to illustrate that we are challenging the Earth system as a whole for our own well-being. And we identified 9 factors, or through quite major synthesis of the literature, we tried to propose at least that there are 5 or 9 key features that keep the Earth system in the desirable Holocene state. And some of those have been presumably exceeded a bit, and that's the red ones. It's amazing how that concept has been taken up by a lot of groups now, and it comes out from three parts of research, actually. One is from ecological economics, going back to Bowling's and Daly's work on Kenneth Bowling, 66, wrote a paper on the coming of the spaceship Earth. We identified human actions in relation to the planet. It has also come out of something called Earth System Science. A lot of natural sciences have done studies on freshwater climate, biochemical cycles, and so on and so forth. And out of that, new synthesis have emerged. And the third pathway is this on the resilience thinking, where you have these dynamics and tipping points and thresholds. So the idea with the planetary boundaries is to try to avoid going into situation where we risk to have big thresholds, actually. So the boundaries is a suggested limit to not go into that dangerous zone where thresholds may happen. So we call it a safe operating space for humanity to stay away from global tipping points. That gets us into resilience thinking. So the first part now was basically about the new global situation that in a very rough way. We have three concepts on the resilience thinking that mentioned very briefly.
And the first is persistence, resilience as persistence. And I think that's what many people think about when they think about resilience, actually, especially in ecology. That's basically how fast you can go back to where you were before. How can you persist where you've been?
Adaptability gets more into this human dimension of resilience, where basically how can we continue to adapt on the same pathway we are on.
We would like to continue our development on a certain pathway. How do we continue that adaptation in the face of these changes? And the third one is transformability,
It's basically the capacity to shift to a new pathway, to not continue on the same one we're on, but to shift into another one. And this is, of course, inspired a lot from complex systems thinking, where you have multiple stability basins, where you have different pathways of development, or different trajectories of development. So the key point here is either staying on the pathway adaptability or shifting into another pathway, transformability. And these interrelate across multiple scales, these type of things. So when it comes to the planet as a whole, the challenge of, as I just briefly mentioned, with the Holocene state is try to persist where we are with the global system, so we don't jump into a situation that will be too hot for any species, basically, or too fluctuating. Because it's easy to imagine what will happen with 7 to 8 billion people in a situation where suddenly rainfall doesn't come in the way it did before, or other features. This sounds very depressing, by the way. So the challenge is really, how can we persist at the global scale? And then lots of people are now arguing that to be able to do that, we have to transform at local and regional scales. We have to change our way of doing things. If we continue as business as usual, it won't work, basically. So we have to figure out ways of transforming. And my take today on transformations is to connect our activities better with the biosphere, basically, to become stewards of the biosphere, to secure the capacity of the Earth system to sustain our own development. In our place, we try to look a little bit at these type of shifts, regime shifts, when you go from one place to another, or how they operate and what they look like. So one aspect there is try to understand and describe regime shifts and their implications. And we have developed a database of a lot of cases of ecological regime shifts, but also social ecological regime shifts that are available on our website if you're interested in that. The next one is really how to try to manage and govern resilience on the current regime you're in, to avoid flipping over into something you don't want to be into. And the third one is how to break the resilience of where you're right now, how to get rid of resilience in an undesirable situation, either to revive something you would like to have, and I think there are lots of restoration efforts and these type of approaches falls into that one, or trying to transform into a new direction. Here's a case from Australia, Golden Brooken catchment, part of Murray-Darling. It's a bit similar to the main story. People have had, and still has, a very well-functioning agricultural systems. But the problem is salinization. So because of clearing of trees and vegetation, the groundwater has moved up into the soils and start to salinize the soils, and which affects production quite a lot. And the adaptation has been there to continue to be on the agriculture path and trying to fix incrementally the salinization problems. But now it has gone to a situation where it's not so easy to fix anymore. In those situations, it becomes almost necessary to try to break the agriculture path. And it's very difficult because it has to do with identities, with your social values, with your legacies, and so on and so forth. So right now in the Golden Brooken catchment, they are in this situation of really trying to refine or reshape their deep values of the land, because they can't do this anymore. They're in a trap. They have to break the trap. So they have to stop adapting in this pathway and try to transform into a new pathway, basically. And the idea is to try to do that before you get too deep into a trap, because if you get too deep into a trap, it may be really costly and almost very difficult to do. Here are a couple of cases that have been able to adapt and also transform to some extent in the face of pretty big shocks. Hurricane Mitch hit Honduras. Beautiful paper by Max Wien and Oliver Coombs from MacGill, illustrating how local communities shifted their whole social structure after the hurricane and
got into a much improved situation for the communities, drawing on historical memories and legacies in that process. Another one is storms and flood management on Cayman Islands that Emma Tompkins worked on learning taking place after storms and floods and being able to cope with storms and floods the next time they come up.
The Great Barrier Reef of Australia, where they have completely shifted the mindset from the reef being pristine to really manage the whole seascape as a unit, dividing it up in 70 different ecosystems and with the goal of strengthening resilience to be able to cope with climate dynamics. These are three examples of attempts to really get at being able to cope with change in a new way. We've been looking into a case in southern Sweden quite a lot, actually, of try to unravel what happened here. Because here they shifted from looking at, this is a small little town here called Kristianstad, that is in the middle of a fairly extensive wetland area with a river in between. There's an agricultural landscape around it, and at the very top of the picture you see the Baltic Sea. They were faced with a couple of crises of risks for flooding, of the wetland growing into the agricultural land, and several of other sort of crises in that region. And they started to mobilize. So the crisis here started to shift their mindsets from looking at water and the areas water sick to water rich. So that's what they call themselves. They call them Kristianstad Vattenrike, which is the kingdom of water in Swedish, actually. So they changed the mindset and started to collaborate with the landscape, not only one group or one company, but coming together in lots of different stakeholders, lots of different groups, and developing a shared vision. They went from looking at sectors or silo management to whole landscape, looking at water and landscape as an integrated unit, and looking at the activities around it, all the way from tourism to food production. But when they did that, they couldn't really take off, because the higher levels of governance, the municipalities and the counties, national legislation did not support that type of transitions. But then there was a window of opportunity when legislation changed and when the county changed administration and so on and so forth, and they could take off and perform a governance transformation, basically how they organized themselves in the landscape. What we found here is four key features that are always taking place in these type of transformations. It's the role of individuals, agency. It's new types of organizations that emerges. It's the norms and rules, the institutions, and it's the social networks. New networks are connected in new ways. So these are four ingredients that always are up and have to be in place to make these type of transformations possible. The role of actors or agency, the role of organizations, institutions, and networks as a unit. Often these are treated as separate things in science, actually. So if you look at political science and other groups, many people look at only at the norms and rules, the institutions. Others specialize in actors and agency. Others specialize in networks. But if you try to look at the real world, you see how they interact. A lot of experimentation and learning going on, and also enabling environments coming from higher levels through legal structures. And now they have become one of UNESCO's Man and the Biosphere areas. I guess as well. So here's a little model of these type of transitions that we looked at in Chile. In Chile, it was a political situation, really bad one, as you may recall, with Pinochet's government, who shook up the country so much that at the end of his period, there was a window of opportunity to restructure coastal zone management completely, actually. And I won't have time to go into that, but that's described in the paper by Stefan Geltrich and several of us in PNS. The second one is from the Great Barrier Reef, which you found in Arulson's paper here, and the third one is in that one, also Terry Chapin's paper in Trends in Ecology and Evolution. What we found is there is a phase of trying preparing for these type of transformations, preparing for these changes. But you can do a lot here, but it's very difficult to take off because you're constrained by other things. It could be economic constraints. It could be no access to markets. It could be government regulations, it could be EU subsidies or a lot of different things. But suddenly things are opening up. You can move the whole thing into a new situation. So you have to be very skillful here in navigating that type of shift. And we found that there are often key leaders, we call them institutional entrepreneurs or champions, who guide these type of shifts and then can move it into a new pathway and then start to build resilience of a new development pathway. So that's a very, very generic model of very complex things happening, actually. But it's an attempt to capture some of that dynamic phenomena. Why I'm emphasizing that is because there's still a tendency often to map out what you see right now and describe it and analyze that as that is the way it's going to be. But the key point here is that we're dealing with dynamics and change, and we're trying to capture these type of interactions. A lot of these actors or agencies are engaged. These are just terminology for describing some of those functions that people are doing in these type of situations. If you're an ecologist, you could think about functional groups or functional types in ecosystems that are necessary for an ecosystem to function. Here, people are performing critical functions to make these transformations possible. Another issue that we've also found is something we call bridging organizations, organizations that can link the local, the incentives from local people all the way up to other levels, often through contacts and social networks. But often new organizations are created for the stewardship down here to be supported and strengthened by other levels and connected even up all the way up to global markets. So bridging, I highlight these two, the agency and the bridging things, because they're not always part of the discussions when you talk about institutional reform and things like that. So, what is this type of transformation then? Well, under the right conditions, they can occur fairly rapidly, from a few years to normally up to a decade. We found that normally up to a decade, that's when you can have a transformation happening, which is extremely fast if you think about it. They're often triggered by some type of perturbation or surprise, which is perceived as crisis or also opportunity. And I think these are well-known phenomena from areas outside environmental areas. And they require sources of resilience, which could be experiences, memories, legacies, worldviews, and things like that, that can be combined with new ways and also create innovations in that process. The key feature here for reconnecting to the biosphere, which sometimes is easy to forget about when we talk about governance and management and institutions, is the level of understanding what you actually are supposed to manage. So the whole bridge here between ecological knowledge and understanding to the ecosystem and to the broader scale is fundamentally important. And I know that some of you have worked also with indigenous groups and traditional ecological knowledge and other types of knowledge systems, profoundly important also to combine. So it's not only scientific understanding, but it's the understanding of the ecosystems that you're living with. And that was the focus of a book we did in 1998 on social ecological resilience, basically. Just to give an example of these type of memories, in urban gardens you have a lot of these type of understanding which people normally don't think about. In Sweden, for example, urban planning, the only green space you found in urban planning are parks and nature reserves. If you look at the city of Stockholm and look at what actually is green, the green space increases 3-4 times. So you include urban gardens, you can include golf courses, you can include villa gardens, cemeteries, and lots of things like that. And it turns out that many of those areas are profoundly important in biodiversity conservation. In Stockholm it was concluded that basically all amphibians had been lost from the city, but all of those were found in the ponds of the golf courses. All these species are there. So there are a lot of green space, and that are people are stewards of at the local level and have a lot of memories and understanding of how to do that. And we use this framework of communities of practice to really really nail down where that understanding sits. So it's in a little piece, Global Environmental Change 2010, on that type of ecological memories. So lots of social processes for sharing the understanding and the insights, but also how you build your environment, and also how you reach out to broader groups
and communicate about it, basically. Okay. I have a few
more slides left. And here is some of the 3 points to sum up some of the things I tried to talk about. Please excuse me, because I'm a Swedish speaker normally. Social adaptation and collective action, detached from stewardship of ecosystems, can lead to vulnerable social ecological systems. So that's the main case, for example. So if you only look at what's going on between people, what's going on in the economy, and draw conclusions that's sustainable, which many people do, that may lead to traps, because you have forgotten about the biosphere, which we are embedded in. That's one of the key lessons there. The second one, the political crisis, I mentioned the one from Chile, that seems to be completely disconnected from environmental issues, can open up windows of opportunities to do something completely new, to actually reconnect and become earth stewards, like Terry Chapin talked about. And another angle, which we have found, but I haven't raised so much today, is that in situations of open access and unsustainable extraction, like illegal overfishing in the Southern Ocean, for example, there can be emergence of governance that is very adaptive all the way up to the global level. And these are a couple of fascinating papers by a guy called Henrik Österblom at the Resilience Center, who described the emergence of few individuals creating networks, actually from Norway, being upset about Norwegian fleets going down to the Southern Ocean and taking part in illegal fishing, and how the illegal fishing has been curbed by almost 90% of the catches through an emergence of a social network connected to the Camelar organizational structure. So you can actually have these type of adaptive governance structures also at an international level. Many people think that they only suitable at the local scale or directly on the ground in connection to a certain ecosystem. But they can happen at the global level and successfully be stewards of regional ecosystems. A couple of issues that are at the front of this type of resilience thinking right now. One is the one that I talked about a lot, is this interplay between periods of rapid change, the shocks and disturbances, and periods of when things are more calmer, how they interact. There's a tendency to look at either one or the other. Either you look at the shocks in themselves, like the disaster literature, for example, or you look at situations like they are right now, without bringing in the shocks. But the combination of those two is a frontier now in research. That way, the scale issue I exemplified with the new case. There's a lot of work now on trying to understand these type of cross-scale interactions, how the local interact with the global, how the global influence the local in truly linked systems. And that's a strong research frontier. Another one is really how you can combine old experiences, the memories of the system with novelty, how innovation is created in that process. And the third is then how all of these can help us transform towards Earth stewardship and reconnect ourselves to the biosphere. So I thought I'd end this talk with a meeting we had last May in Stockholm called the Third Nobel Laureate Symposium on Global Sustainability. It was the third in a series started by Potsdam Institute with Angela Merkel. And the second one was hosted here in the UK with Cambridge University and I think Prince Charles was the host of it. And we were asked, because we are the Bayer Institute is part of the Royal Academy of Sciences, and we were asked to host the third one. So we gathered some 20 Nobel laureates and 20 researchers in this area and produced a bit similar to what I talked about today, three background papers for that. And
and they are out in a special issue of
Ambia. I only have two copies with me, but at least it exists. And the first one is really about this challenge of reconnecting to the biosphere. The second one is the state-of-the-art synthesis of the Anthropocene, how humans are shaping the planet. And the third is really, how can we transform? And one interesting conclusion in that one, coming from Sander van der Leeuwen, archaeologist at Arizona, part of that paper, is that a lot of the technological change we have seen in the last 100 years or so has reinforced the current pathway. It has created a lot of innovation, but it has reinforced the current pathway. Out of that, we did a memorandum called Stockholm Memorandum on Global Sustainability. And there were three sort of points in that one. Planetary boundaries, those I mentioned before. The planetary opportunities for shifting pathways and planetary stewardship or Earth stewardship, as Terry Chapin talks about. It was strongly emphasized that the biosphere, that the environment is not just a sector anymore, it's a precondition for good social and economic development. It's not about saving the environment, it's about our own future. And the third, that it's not just climate, it's global change that we have to navigate. And at that meeting, actually, we were contacted by a commission that Ban Ki-moon, UN, put together called the High-Level Panel on Global Sustainability. It was led by Tarja Halonen from Finland and Jakob Zuma from South Africa. So they came to this meeting, and we had a sort of in the Academy, Royal Academy, we have a room with all the portraits from Linnaeus and forward. So we had the ceremony there when the thing was handed over. It's a very nice moment. And obviously, I think we have been a bit influenced because the report was just released now. It's called Resilient People, Resilient Planet: A Future Worth Choosing. So I think I end by that slide. And this report was being presented in different parts of the world now as a key input from this commission to Rio Plus 20 now in the summer. And it was released in January. Okay, thank you very much.